for the people who came into the website at selectivemutismseminar.com. But just to reflect for a moment as we're starting this conference, I'm sitting here in my office and I have a few people on the line who are going to be presenting with me and sharing their stories. And it's a very interesting phenomenon. I've done way over 1,000 TV and radio shows. And every time I do a show, I've done everything from Oprah Winfrey to Opie and Anthony, who are two crazy people who made Howard Stern look tame. I've done tape shows and live shows in studio, in my home. Every time I do a show, my hands get cold. And it's an interesting phenomenon because this is part of the physiology of performance, which is a very important thing to understand when dealing with selective mutism. I'm having fun here tonight. I'm going to anyway, and I'm excited because there's an audience and we're going to help people. But my blood vessels are constricting because of the performance pressure. And the more that you understand what the physiology of performance is, which is something we will discuss as we get into the seminar, the more you will be able to help people that you're concerned about with selective mutism. To start with, very simply, let's do a diagnostic with selective mutism. If you know a person, or we're talking about your child, if this person can talk, if you know the person can talk, and the child does not talk outside of the home, to specific people, or in specific venues, selective mutism is present. It's not a complicated situation. Quite frankly, there's no need to do elaborate diagnostics to define selective mutism. It's important to know if other variables are there, like learning disabilities, developmental problems, medical issues. But to diagnose selective mutism, very simply, if you know the person can talk and the person doesn't talk, selective mutism is there. Now, my philosophy in life and my philosophy behind the clinical work that I do is that time is your most valuable asset in life. You can borrow money, you can't borrow time. Time is not elastic, it doesn't stretch. And when selective mutism is present, we have a severe form of social anxiety. You've got to think of selective mutism as social anxiety. And one of the things that I want to do in this seminar is to demystify it. If you understand the problem in terms of thinking, behavior, emotion, physiology, and family dynamics, which are so important, you have much more potential to be able to control it. Now, just a pinch of a background about me. Since 1978, I have worked with, and my staff and I have worked with approximately 10,000 people, that's not an exaggeration, with social anxiety. Many different ages, all kinds of cultures from around the world. And many of these people have had selective mutism. Children, adolescents, and adults. The way that I got into, I'm asked this question a lot, the way that I got into social anxiety, I did not have social anxiety. A lot of people ask me that. But what happened was when I got out of graduate school, I was working as a youth worker in a community center, and one of my associates happened to be doing special education for the Girl Scouts. And she had a great idea. She said, let's start a socialization program for teenagers with learning disabilities. I really had no idea what she was talking about, but we started this program and we started doing interviews with families and teenagers with learning problems. We were talking about this social group that we were forming, and then a very interesting thing happened. After we would do the interview, the kids wouldn't come back. I said, wow, what's going on here? And that's how I really discovered what social anxiety was, a very specific kind of fear. That was in 1978, before social anxiety was a popular word. That was the seed of what now is the evolution of my practice. And you're going to hear some of the work that we have done tonight. Now, the biggest mistake, the very biggest mistake that is made regarding selective mutism, and there were a number, this related to a number of the questions that were asked at the website. When will my child talk in school? Will selective mutism just run its course? Will my child grow out of the problem? Well, the biggest mistake that is made is to believe, not only for social anxiety, but for selective mutism, is to believe that the child will grow out of the problem. And for those of you who have invested in this belief. I'd like you to listen very carefully now to Mike, who is an ex-patient of mine. He's someone who has graduated from the program, and he came to me as an adult. He had social anxiety and selective mutism, and I'd like Mike to tell his story. So please listen very carefully, because as you hear the people talk, you're going to hear the answers of how to resolve the problem. They have the answers, so listen very carefully. Mike, I'd like you to start by describing what was going on when you first contacted me.
When I first contacted you, I was 30 years old, and I didn't talk to anyone. I had no friends. I never went anywhere. All I did was go to work and go home, and that was my life. It was basically, wasn't doing anything with my life. And it all started when I was about in seventh grade, about 12 years old. I wasn't very talkative before that, but I did have some friends. But after about 12 years old, I became very shy and withdrawn. I started to lose friends, and by the time I was in 12th grade, or graduated from 12th grade, I didn't have any friends at all. So that went on for a number of years. I basically just went to work and went home, and I went through a lot of trouble just to avoid conversations with people. I would make sure I wasn't in any situations where I would have to talk to people. And until I was about 30, I decided that I was tired of this life, living like this, and I wanted to get some help, and that's when I went to Jonathan.
So when were you, just to elaborate again, when were you first aware that you yourself had a problem?
I actually didn't realize that I had a problem until I was about 18. At the time when I knew I didn't have any friends, I actually didn't think of it as a problem. I thought it would go away, but it never went away. It just got worse. And it wasn't until I was about 30 that I realized, hey, I gotta really get some help, or else I'm gonna be like this for the rest of my life, and I didn't want to be like that.
Okay, be very clear for the people who are listening. The impact of this problem on your life was what?
No friends, no relationships with anyone. Prevented me from having being successful in life. It just crippled my life. I really couldn't do anything with my life.
Okay, now I remember you told me that you decided you're a bright guy. You got out of high school with a B-plus average or something like that,
mm-hmm.
and you decided not to go to college because of this problem, right?
Right. In high school, I remember just being in class and not participating with anything. It was like I was there, but I wasn't really there. So, and I thought of college as being the same way, and I didn't want to go through that again because it was like such a bad experience for me. So because of that, the problems that I had, I decided not to go to college.
Also, correct me if I say anything that's not accurate, but when you first came to me, you were suffering from depression, right?
Yes, I was also depressed. I was quite depressed. Nothing was going on in my life. I didn't have any friends or anything, and I was lonely, and that really caused a lot of depression.
Okay, now, listeners, I want you to really understand something. Mike is an adult, and his parents didn't get involved in any treatment, okay? They didn't start anything when Mike was growing up. They were distancing themselves. They were kind of detached from the problem. They really didn't know what was going on. They were confused. Mike has something that's called initiative. Initiative is not ability. Initiative means to start up. As an adult, he researched getting help. He came out on his own. And he negotiated the whole process of getting help. There are two basic types of people who have the problem with social anxiety. There are many different manifestations of it: fear of public speaking, selective mutism, fear of authority figures, panic attacks in social situations, fear of intimacy. The list goes on and on. But there are two types of people who have the problem. One is the person who's capable of initiative. Everybody else is not. Now, the 6-year-olds, the 12-year-olds, many 26-year-olds do not have initiative. So parents are left with choices to make. Either they learn how to compensate, to make up for the person's lack of initiative, or they will unwittingly be enabling, worsening the problem. Mike, where are you at now in your life?
I would say I'm about 85-90% cured of social anxiety. Today I have a lot of friends. I have a social life. I go out with friends, you know, hang out and all that. And I'm going to be getting married soon.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And today my life is much better, and I'm much happier. I'm not depressed anymore. And, you know, every day I get up and I look forward to a new day. Before, it wasn't like that at all.
Okay, now, what are the key things that you had to do to turn the problem around? Obviously, you came for help, but what did you have to do to resolve the problem?
Well, one of the biggest things was I didn't go anywhere, so I said to myself, you know, I have to go where people are. And to overcome my fears of being around people and talking with them. So I actually put myself out there, you know, outside of my house. I had to leave the house. And one of the things I did, I started taking dance lessons, and I got into dancing, which was which helped me a lot, because, of course, you're going to meet people doing that. And that helped me a great deal. It got me out of my comfort zone. I had to talk to people, you know. And that was one of the biggest things that helped me. But another thing was I was also determined to overcome my problem. And I really wanted to try. It was very hard for me. It wasn't easy, but I was determined to overcome my problem. That's another thing.
Okay. I thank you for sharing. And, you know, I want you to hang on for the rest of the seminar, because I want to get back to you later on. In order to understand selective mutism, as I said before, it's imperative to understand what social anxiety is. Social anxiety is a very specific form of fear. It's fear based on performance. And as I said before, there are many different examples of what it is. But again, when you think of it as attitude, behavior, thinking, emotion, physiology, and family dynamics. Now, I'm going to tell you an interesting story at the risk of this being too controversial. About 4 or 5 years ago, I spoke to a person who is another expert in selective mutism. It's hard to find experts in social anxiety. It's even harder to find them in selective mutism. And this person, who's fairly well known, I had a conversation with this person, and it was very interesting. She was doing a lot of diagnostics, but she had never taken a person through a treatment process. She was only doing diagnostics. I found that to be very, very interesting. And obviously, we're not going to mention any names here. Now, you're going to be 50% of the way there in terms of resolving the problem if you can understand what I'm about to say now. And that is, along with social anxiety, you have to understand what's called the avoidance and dependency syndrome. And this is something that is so misunderstood by the psychotherapy profession and the medical community. Another letter that someone wrote, another question is, what do you do when the child won't speak to the therapist? What do you do when the child won't follow through on homework given by the therapist? Well, you know, my answer to that is you've got to find a therapist, which is hard to do, who understands what avoidance and dependency is. When the person has selective mutism, think of it as when anxiety gets to the point that you avoid something completely, it becomes a phobia. So selective mutism is a phobia about speaking. Think of it as an addiction to the avoidance of speaking, an addiction to the avoidance of speaking. That's literally what it is. Now, that is a form of avoidance. In order to be really, really good at being avoidant, a person also has to be very dependent. That's where the parents or caregivers come into play. Another question that was asked by a lot of people, what kind of therapy works for selective mutism? What kind of therapist should be working, which therapist is most equipped to treat selective mutism? Well, the answer to that is the person who understands social anxiety and selective mutism. It's the person who understands the avoidance and dependency syndrome. One-to-one therapy with a selectively mute child is ridiculous. Taking a person to a speech therapist is ridiculous. Selective mutism is not a speech problem. It turns into a major communication problem. But for all the kids who are in school who get supportive speech services, 95% of the time it's impotent because it's not a speech disorder. It's an anxiety disorder. Now, the person you're going to listen to next, listen very carefully, because Lynn, who's in California, has a very interesting story to tell. And if you listen very carefully, parents, you're going to hear the keys, the key points of what's necessary to help your children either resolve or perhaps cure the problem. So, Lynn, would you be kind enough to share your story and start with what was happening when you first contacted me?
When I first contacted you, my daughter had been diagnosed selectively mute for a good 3 years. And we had been through quite a few therapists, and we had been through speech therapy. We had been to a psychiatrist, and we had spent a good 3 years just trying to figure out how to handle this thing that was diagnosed as selective mutism. And where we were at was I was told she has selective mutism, and I was to just stop speaking for her. And it was a difficult situation because I did not know how to make that transition from speaking almost 100% for her to letting her handle herself 100% of the time.
Lynn, be clear again about when you should tell specifically, just so the listeners really get it, what was going on in school, you know?
Okay, sure. She was not speaking to any adults other than her parents, my husband and myself, her grandparents, and her brother. She spoke to maybe a couple of the children in the classroom, and there was absolutely no communication with the teachers verbally. She participated in the classroom only to a small degree because she couldn't do what the children were doing in the classroom, like reading aloud or asking questions. And so she really just didn't participate the way that she could have in a better situation.
Now, I would imagine that this caused a fair amount of stress for the parents.
It caused a lot of stress for the parents, meaning me and her father, because we just didn't know what to do. And the teachers didn't know what to do. And if we took her into a social situation where somebody addressed her, we just knew she wasn't going to answer them. And it was going to be us that was going to turn around and answer the questions for her. We knew that being at a birthday party was just going to be so hard for her, and she wasn't going to be able to get in there and participate with the rest of the children that were just having a really good time. And it was very difficult for us because it was just so confusing for us, and it was embarrassing sometimes for us, and it was also very sad to just see her not be able to have a good time.
And what feedback were you getting from teachers, the people in school?
The teachers honestly didn't know what to do. They would basically just kind of accept her at a different standard than the other children. They wouldn't have the same expectations as they would for the other children. School, the psychologist within the school basically just told us, don't give her anything if she doesn't ask for it. And, of course, that situation just failed miserably, and we'd end up giving her whatever she needed or even speaking for her.
Uh-huh. Where is Sydney at now?
She is just such a happy child now. Things have changed so much for her. She plays basketball. She plays soccer. She's, within the last 2 years, since she's been doing so much better, she has performed in 4 different plays, and she's gearing up to do another one here in just a couple months. She plays piano, and she enjoys playing for people. She has a really great teacher this year who will let her just get up in the middle of class and play piano. So I think that's a pretty wonderful thing. And she's doing jobs around the neighborhood. When people go out of town, they come to her, and she feeds their dogs and bathes them and takes in their mail. And she has a really great group of friends.
Where is she at with the selective mutism?
She does not have selective mutism anymore.
I know I'm leading you here, but do you feel comfortable? I'm very careful when I use the word cured. I really have to be professional, ethical, and conservative. Would you say she's cured with selective mutism?
She is definitely cured of selective mutism. She is not dependent on me to do any type of verbal communication for her.
Okay, how did you do it?
Well, it was a definite process that we went through. We started out within just our own home. We had to change things in our own home. We had to help her to become more independent. She needed to take responsibility for choosing her own clothes and dressing and bathing for school, taking care of packing her own lunch. And then we moved on to what is called, I don't know if it's your term or our term, but it's freezing the moment. And we used that whenever anybody would approach her and speak to her. We would make sure we took a moment before we immediately answered for her. And she began to get the message that we weren't going to just jump in.
And you knew that by doing that, you would be causing stress for your child, right?
It did cause stress for her. And it definitely caused stress for my husband and myself. Those brief moments that were frozen were full of anxiety, but it gave us an opportunity to feel it and deal with it. And eventually, as a family, we were able to work through our own anxieties of those silent moments.
Okay, which is a very important part of the process, and I do want to come back to that, but the point that I want to make is that, and this is what becomes so confusing, here we have a parent who said that her child with selective mutism is cured. I never met the child until after treatment. They happened to come to New York during the last 5% of treatment. This was all done via parenting technique. And, you know, something very important here, that is that a lot of times parents are put on the defensive by therapists. As a matter of fact, way back when in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, selective mutism used to be called elective mutism, and then they changed it to selective mutism for a number of reasons, and there was a lot of process going into this, and I know some of the parents were involved in the process, and they felt very defensive because, you know, people were saying, well, kids with selective mutism are abused and they've had trauma, and there's so much confusion. Sometimes it's really hard for parents to look at their role in this situation. We are not blaming anyone. One of the most important points that I want to make tonight is to give the listeners belief that there is an answer to the problem. But belief is in the parents compensating for the lack of initiative on the part of the children. The six-year-old is just not going to have initiative. And I got to tell you something, it's a lot easier to deal with the six-year-old than the 26-year-old. The average age in my practice over the last 20 years has been probably 27, 28 years old. Okay, now, we know that selective mutism is social anxiety. It's an addiction to the avoidance of speaking. It is a phobia for speaking, and it certainly is a precursor for fear of public speaking, which is the number one phobia in this country, and a specific example of social phobia. Often people, children with selective mutism can be oppositional. Very often, not that that's the primary diagnosis, but sometimes the mutism can take on the character of being oppositional. Often, selective mutism can be part of a special needs scenario or a developmental problem. So at this point, I'd like to introduce you to Ellen, who's going to tell you the story of her child who had selective mutism, who also had special needs. Ellen?
Yes. David was born very, you know, quite normal, except for the fact that he had a small problem that needed to be corrected. And when he was 8 months old, there was a on his hands, he had some webbing between his fingers. Other than that, he was perfectly normal child. Prior to the surgery at 8 months, he was saying mama, dada, smiling, laughing. When you would sing Old MacDonald Had a Farm, he would sing E-I-E-I-O. And then he had the surgery. And unbeknownst to us, there was a problem during the surgery with the anesthesia. And he sustained oxygen deprivation and some brain damage, and we were not apprised of any of this. So he continued on, and he didn't seem the same. He wasn't doing what he was doing prior to the surgery. We just moved on, and I thought it was the trauma of the surgery, and the doctor didn't seem to say anything to us at any point. At the age of 19 months, he had grand mal seizures and was hospitalized, and we were told at that point that developmentally he was like a nine-month-old. Physically, emotionally, his weight, everything was like a nine-month-old. And from that point on, he didn't speak. He didn't continue to speak. He didn't continue to go along with what he had been doing prior to the surgery. We began special services for him. He went 4 days a week, year-round, until he was 4 years of age, to a special therapeutic setting where they did work with him with patterning and all kinds of different things, and still there was no change. We knew he understood us because if you would say, do you want milk, he would nod, or he would point to the refrigerator, or somehow he let us know what he needed, but he didn't speak. When he was 4 years of age, he started a program in our city, and a traditional therapist, a traditional psychologist, was one of the people involved in the program, who was quite wonderful, and David began to go to this therapist for help. The therapist tried in every single which way there would be, with art therapy, with pictures, with, because David did not speak, and worked with him trying to bring him out, trying to, you know, get from him what he needed, and that did not help as well. When David was 11 years of age, he went to a special camp for the first time, a sleepaway camp. And during that summer, there was an overnighter or there was a day trip in the nearby woods, and somehow he got lost from the group. They kept, you know, looking for him and shouting for him and shouting for him, and to no avail, they couldn't find him. So this went on for about a half hour until finally one of the counselors had the very, very good idea of saying, if you hear us, bang some sticks together. And in like 1 second, he banged sticks together. So this child was unable or not willing, whatever the issues were, to save his own self by just yelling out. He couldn't do that. We were desperate. We wanted to get help for him. We knew he could speak. And I kept saying, if only I could find someone to show me what to do for my son. I don't know what to do for my son. And I tuned into a radio program, 11 o'clock on a Sunday evening, and I heard the MC announce Jonathan Berendt, Social Anxieties, and I was transfixed. I just listened to what you had to say. I waited until September, because this was in June. I waited till September, and I called you, and you did indeed teach us what to do for our son.
Okay, what did I teach you?
Well, you taught us not to enable him to continue being a selective mute. David, from the first moment, I mean, we took into our hearts what you said to us. And I remember the first time we went as a family to a restaurant, as we did many times before. And, you know, normally David would point to what he wanted, and we would say to the waitress what he wanted. And this time, I remember it so vividly because it was so outstanding. And I get very emotional. You will forgive me. I said to my son, we are not going to order for you. If you want something to eat, you will have to order it yourself. And he looked at me like like I was crazy. And I said, I'm very, very serious. We are not going to order your dinner for you. You will have to do it for yourself, or you're not going to eat. We will sit here and eat, and you will sit and watch us. And I told the waitress, our son may take a little time till he orders, but he will order his dinner. And we all ordered ours, and she stood there, and everyone looked at him, and he knew. He just knew, I guess, that the jig was up, because he ordered a hamburger, French fries, and a soda.
Okay, so that was the turning point with your parenting technique.
Yes.
Where is David at now? And please, listeners, I beg of you, do not get off the phone tonight and take your kids to a restaurant and force them to order by themselves, okay? Please don't do it, because the technique that you're hearing, and we're going to go over the specifics of the technique, it's a system. It's a methodology. And if you don't do it within the context of a methodology, you will be making the situation worse. Mm-hmm. Where is David at now?
David is working, and David lives on his own. David takes care of all his needs. David orders in restaurants. David goes into stores and purchases whatever clothing he needs for himself. He will make reservations. He does all, he lives his life. He has social things. He has friends. He is learning disabled. He is not... he has friends who are learning disabled, and he has friends who are not learning disabled. And he lives a very lovely life.
And what you learned how to do is to, as well as Lynn with her parenting, is to invest in your child's ability versus disability.
Yes.
Now, it's very easy to go on the internet to do research on selective mutism and to find all kinds of insight. And one of the things I've discussed with many parents is don't create stress for your child. Well, I don't think that the people who are giving that kind of information have clinically been on the front line with selective mutism, or they may not understand the operational definition of stress. The only person who does not have stress is a dead person. And what you have to learn, there's good stress and there's bad stress. You know, good stress is my hands are cold, I'm performing here tonight, doing a show, whatever, okay? Again, there's the physiology of performance, whether it's talking, public speaking, athletic performance, performing on stage, whatever it may be. But the child must learn how to negotiate stress. There's no way around it. Now, I want to go over briefly here the basic steps of what is needed to turn the situation around. Now, I was going to have a fourth person talk tonight. This is a and I'm going to have her on next week. This is a person in Miami who reversed the selected mutism. Never, the 6.5-year-old never spoke to the mother. Never. Reversed it in 5 sessions. This is after a custody battle. The child was living with the father in New York. She's in Miami, but her phones were wiped out tonight because of the hurricane. But you're going to hear that story next week. Here are the basic steps. Number one, you have to understand selective mutism as an anxiety disorder. It's not a speech disorder. It's not autism. It's an anxiety disorder. It's a phobia. It's an addiction to the avoidance of speaking. Next, you've got to understand the avoidance dependency syndrome. You've got to understand that as a caregiver, as a parent, you are the person dependent upon. You have the power to facilitate the resolution of this problem for your children. In order to do that, next step, parents have to resolve their own confusion and anxiety. Briefly, Ellen, did you have anxiety in the process of reparenting?
Oh, yes.
How so, briefly?
Well, you know, you don't want to you love your child, you don't want to upset your child, but by not upsetting or not pushing David, we enabled him to stay mute. So it was initially anxiety, and then afterwards it was just total reward seeing him blossom.
Okay, Lynn, did you have to confront anxiety?
Yes. Both my husband and I had to confront anxiety because we just had this fear or this problem with concerned about overstressing her or putting too much stress on her.
And Mike, obviously, you know, you on your own with initiative had to confront your own anxiety. And now another question that was asked a lot is, where does selective mutism come from? Are people born this way? Is it genetic? Is it learned? That kind of stuff. There's a genetic predisposition to everything in life, but the worst mistake that anybody can make is to say, "Oh my God, I was born this way. There's nothing I can do about it." You can compensate for the predisposition, and I've got literally thousands of stories of people who have. The next step is you've got to develop a team approach for parenting, and this is no little thing. This is no little thing. Because the child of whatever age, and again, a lot of very, another question was, how does selective mutism relate to gifted children? A lot of children who have selective mutism are gifted, very intelligent. What happens is that the child... Human beings have two basic drives, seek pleasure and avoid pain. And very sadly, people with social anxiety mistake pleasure for the avoidance of discomfort and pain. So what happens is as the child is growing up, they are very keen at sensing the difference in parenting styles. And it's not as though they sit there saying, "Well, gee, how can I get over on my mother and father?" But it becomes a structural reflex where they learn how to play the differences in parenting out to avoid, keyword, avoidance, what's threatening. When parents get on the same team, obviously it's normal to have disagreements, but you want to do them behind closed doors. And Lynn, I remember you telling me that you and your husband would do a lot of talking every day. You'd have some mutual coaching sessions, and you know, that's fabulous stuff. When the child learns that the parents are on the same team. Now, this is a critical issue here. They learn that they have to access a different part of the brain. Now, this is where the physiology comes into play. If a child's sitting there and likes playing the computer and watching TV, you know, they're having fun, no big deal. But to talk or to do problem solving independently at a higher level, you literally have to access physiologically another part of the brain. And they don't want to do it because it feels uncomfortable. When they learn that there's a new set of expectations, they're able to grow. Think of the muscle. Think of the brain as a muscle. You go to the gym, you work out your right arm, you don't work out your left arm, your right arm will grow, your left arm will atrophy. So part of the brain in the selectively mute child will atrophy if it is not worked out. Literally, things like brainwave changes and blood flowing into specific areas of the brain happen with at different rates with different challenges. So being on the same team is super important. And next, we come to a very, very critical issue, and that is to understand the concept of nurturing. Most of the parents that I work with selectively mute kids, are very loving parents who have gotten confused on the concept of nurturing, mistaking nurturing for rescuing. the ultimate image of nurturing, if you go into a textbook, is infant in mother's breast. If you get too much of that, literally and metaphorically, it breeds over dependence. Going back to this, there's a very interesting story. The woman who reversed the situation in 5 sessions. The father, with whom the child lived for a year prior to the mother getting custody, very loving father, very loving family. And what the family would do is they would talk for the child, they would think for the child, they would dress the child. This child had normal intelligence. They would bathe him. They would undress him for the shower. What they were doing was they were infantilizing him. And the mother told me of the father. The father, in describing the child, was saying, "Oh, he's my little butterfly." So I think that, you know, that gave me a lot of insight, you know, thinking of this as little butterfly syndrome. And you have to think, parents, if you are susceptible to this, because you love your child so much, the overprotection, not wanting to see your child experience stress. So learning the concept of nurturing. Nurturing means provide support, promote growth. There's a saying in the office of my wall, on the wall of my office, rather. I don't know who the author is. But the role of parents is to provide children with roots for security and wings to fly. In the case of selective mutism, the roots are really strong, but there's a dramatic need for wing development. And that's what corrective parenting is all about. So you want to invest in the child's ability, not disability. You want to set limits and consequences. Many letters that came in were saying, what do we do with the child who has temper tantrums? They act out. Usually not in school. They act out at home. What's this all about? It's frustration. It's frustration about not getting what they want in life and negotiating for themselves. And they have exaggerated emotions, you know, very frequently. It's nurturing means to teach the child that the temper tantrum will not get them what they want, and that there is productive communication, and it's important to learn how to facilitate communication and the expression of emotion in a productive way with your children. So we're talking about empowering versus enabling, and we're talking again about the whole issue of stress. The only way that you're going to get better is to teach your child to avoid stress. Again, a lot of letters were saying, you know, should I put my child in this situation because it will cause stress? Well, as part of a methodology, yes. One woman wrote, we're thinking about homeschooling the child. My personal philosophy with homeschooling is you're going to lose a battle. You may not lose the war, but you're losing an important battle when you get into the direction of homeschooling. And you want to create an empowering methodology. The key word is methodology. Now, the starting point of turning things around when you hang up the phone tonight, the starting point is from this moment on, do not put pressure on your child to talk. Don't beg, don't plead, don't show your own anxiety. If you have anxiety, hide it. What you want to do is you want to create, as a team, a new set of expectations to which the child has to adapt. You know, when the parent says, are you going to talk when you go to so-and-so's house? You got to stop that. Because the child is sensing the parent's anxiety, and that is feeding the pathology. You want to retrain their thinking. You're teaching the child that he or she has to adapt to society, not the other way around. That is crucial. Now, let's talk about medicine for a minute. Again, I'm trying to, you know, put a lot of information into a short period of time. Medicine. The biggest mistake that is made is to think the child will grow out of the problem. The second biggest mistake is misuse of medicine. There is a right and a wrong way to use medicine. Now, we're going to get into medicine in detail next time when we have a very experienced psychiatrist talk about the subject. But I'm going to give you the basic parameters of how to use medicine. When the reparenting process, the corrective parenting process, is in effect and the child has a new set of expectations, the child understands that he or she is expected to talk or to think in a certain way, when they are grossly inhibited or paralyzed, at that point, And, you know, in terms of when people are working with me, it's usually something like 3 months down the road. If they are really paralyzed, at that point, we use medicine. The purpose of the medicine being a tool to create a sense of ease in the brain so that the child can more easily adapt to the normal productive pressure, expectations rather, that are put on him or her. It's not a cure. And when people think that medicine is the answer without the corrective parenting, they're setting the child up, in most cases, for more problems with overdependence. And this problem doesn't go away. You heard Mike talk. He didn't grow out of the problem. At age 30, he had major issues, and he, thank goodness, he had the courage to face his anxiety and to turn it around. But again, there's a right and a wrong way to use medicine. There's all kinds of stuff, complications with school issues. It's tough stuff because a lot of the questions that I got were from speech therapists and teachers, and what do I do to help the child in the classroom? There's no 1-2-3 technique. The way to turn this around is to create a structure that the child has to adjust to. Now, there's a lot of enabling that goes on in the classroom. Ellen, do you remember what was going on with David?
Oh, yes. He was allowed to not speak. They would let him point. They didn't want to upset him. In fact, they wanted to teach him sign language, and we knew that this was not what should be done. And in fact, you went down to the school and you gave a good, I'm sure, lecture to the teachers. And even after that, they had anxiety about upsetting David. So when we went up for open school week and the teacher again wanted to teach him sign language, I said, how about doing this? And using your techniques that you taught us, I said to her, how about if David could come up and whisper the answers in your ear? And we made that his goal, and he did that. Then we came up a month later, and the next goal was that David would have to talk from about 12 inches from the teacher's ear. And he did that. And then it was from his seat, and that was it. I mean, it was just that. It sounds that simple, but it took a lot because we had to sort of encourage the teacher because she was so anxiety-stricken.
Right, and you have to be fair with the teachers because if they have a class of 20 or 30 kids, there's limited time that they can give the individual student, especially
right.
When we're talking about a freeze-the-moment technique. Lynn, do you remember what happened when we interacted with Sydney's teacher?
Yeah, it was, I think it was very difficult for her to, the teacher, because frankly, I don't know if she had the time to deal with a lot of the situations that she was put in with Sydney. And the teacher began to just rely on one of Sydney's friends that she spoke to. She put like Sydney's best little friend next to her, and she would say, okay, what did Sydney say? What answer did she give for this? And then the girl would relay that to the teacher, and she also accepted just pointing or just hearsay from me how Sydney did or how Sydney read. It was
And now both Ellen and Lynn, as well as the person who's not on tonight who will be on next week, did advocate for in the school for the children, which is a big part of nurturing. And we're going to get more into that next session when we talk about the legal issues, you know, and options you have. What happened in Lynn's situation is I had a couple of consults with the teacher. I talked to her for 5 minutes every few weeks, something like that. And she was doing pretty good for a while. And then what happened was she burnt out. The stress overwhelmed her, and all of the work that we were doing in teaching the teacher not to enable, she caved in, and she just stopped doing it. And thank goodness that the parenting technique was strong enough to compensate for what was not happening in the classroom. But I got to tell you something. There's no way, I'm not saying no way, but the odds are that if the restructuring is not happening in the home, you can forget about success happening in the class. With reparenting happening in the home, there's a very good chance that there will be a segue into school issues. But you got to be very careful about that. A lot of people get frustrated that teachers don't know how to handle the situation. I had one parent advocated for her child, and the school psychologist was telling the teacher to do a point system, which is you'll get points if you talk. I mean, on the surface, that makes sense, right? But what they did not understand was that's exactly the type of pressure that paralyzes the selectively mute child. When they start talking, they do not want to have attention focused on them. That makes it worse. That increases the anxiety. So again, it comes back to a matter-of-fact way of doing something to restructure the set of expectations to which the child has to adjust. Now, let me cruise through some of these quickly through some of the questions. What is the single most important thing I can do to help my daughter with SM? Well, to understand the concepts of avoidance and dependence and the role of parents. Should we have the assumption that as our daughter matures, she will find it easier to talk in social settings in school? If you want to reinforce the pathology, which means disease, that's what you want to think. When can we expect or hope for out loud talking in the school setting for a six-year-old? If you don't do appropriate intervention, I would not invest in hope. I don't mean to be negative. I'm just being realistic. You see, having done this kind of work, again, 10,000 people later, I have seen absolutely, I don't think I could hear anything new that I haven't heard about social anxiety and selective mutism. I have seen everything from a total cure to the problem being permanent and everything in between. And there's lots of scary stories. Mike is a great success story. He had courage. There's lots of stories of adults who are living at home, who are not functioning, who are depressed, because depression is a natural byproduct of social anxiety, where the problem has been permanent because the parents never took any action. How can you be most successful at therapy with children who won't speak to their therapist? Get a therapist who knows what they're doing. Is selective mutism often misdiagnosed as Asperger's? It can be. When will my daughter feel comfortable enough to talk in public? That depends on the nature of the work that is done to challenge the selective mutism. Within the professional community, who is most adept at helping children overcome it? The person who understands the problem. The answer is not a psychologist, social worker, psychiatrist, art therapist. It's the person who understands the problem. My son is being treated for SM with counseling and meds but cannot accomplish any of the tasks. What should be next? The parents have to be involved. It's up to the parents. If we're talking about children and adolescents, it's much more up to the parents than any one-to-one kind of one-to-one process. How long usually will it take after treatment for a child to be cured from selective mutism? Okay, that depends on the length of the problem, the severity of the problem, the cooperation of the patients, and that includes the parents, obviously, because assume the child won't be cooperative, and many variables such as that. Is it more difficult to treat a teenager with this SM than a small child? Yes, it is, because what happens is that the more the anxiety remains a constant, it accrues. Think of it as you're investing. You put money in the bank. You're collecting interest. Anxiety gets worse with time, and what happens is it works its way insidiously into the personality structure, and there you have the dynamics of avoidance and dependence. Why are temper tantrums associated with social anxiety? Because of the frustration and an exaggerated emotion that the child is experiencing. Why does our daughter get violent and hit her sister and parents at home when she doesn't do that in school? Same thing. Does childhood SM causes language difficulties in adulthood? It causes communication problems in adulthood. Mike, let me come back to you for a minute. Just give a minute on an example of how you had to challenge your anxiety, what went through your mind, and how you allowed yourself to talk in threatening situations as an adult.
Well, before I started to get help, or even while when I first started with the program, when I would talk to someone, I would think to myself that I didn't have anything to say, and I wanted the conversation to end. So what I realized was that I really do have something to say, and I had to like black out that voice in my head telling me you don't have anything to say, stop talking. So just by doing that and just by knowing that I really do have something to say, that helped me out a lot.
And I think that the more, remember the times that you would go dancing, right?
Yeah.
Mike is a dancer, he's a good dancer. And you would want to, at the beginning, you would want to talk, you wouldn't talk. What was happening?
Yeah, I would want to, like, say, like, a hello to someone or ask them their name or something. And at the beginning, I just couldn't do it, and no matter how much I really wanted to, because part of the purpose of me going dance was also to socialize with people, and that was, like, one of the things I wanted to do. And I always had that in my head that I don't have anything to say, don't talk, or people won't find you interesting. And it was all not true.
Okay, with risk taking again, Mike had initiative to take risks. Your small children do not. My son is 15 and has no friends and does not talk much. What can I do? You can learn how not to enable. You have to teach your children how to survive in life. I'll give you a quick story. I had, at one time in my practice, I had two people who were in their 30s come to the practice at the same time from a well-known clinic in the Midwest that supposedly had a program for social phobia. They both got to me. They both were overly medicated. They didn't work. Their parents financed their lifestyle for big bucks. And what would happen with both of these adult children is that when they did not get what they wanted, money, support, whatever, they would threaten suicide, which is the ultimate temper tantrum. And it's this kind of fear. You know, when you think right now, what's going to happen when I put too much stress on my six-year-old? If you don't resolve it now, it sometimes evolves into that kind of fear. Well, the parents were never involved in the therapy that these people received at this well-known clinic. My interpretation is that the people in the clinic did not know how to treat social anxiety. Because, you know, if a person comes to me to therapy, if a person's an adult and does research and kind of pays their own way, we don't involve parents, okay, because they're independent, okay? But if there's financial dependency as well as emotional or practical dependency, you must involve the parents and teach them what to do, or you'll be accomplishing absolutely nothing. Should I enroll my SM child in extracurricular activities? I don't want her to miss out on fun, but I know she will not participate and it may cause more social anxiety. It's an excellent question. And parents have to model for their children what appropriate social behavior is. Providing them with social opportunities is nurturing. Dealing with stress and anxiety is nurturing if you do it as part of a methodology. So again, I beg of you, please don't go out tonight and start, you know, in a fragmented fashion not talking for your child. Do it as part of a system, as a methodology. Last words of wisdom, parents. Ellen, one piece of advice for the people, for other parents?
Don't give up. It can. If my son could turn it around to the degree he has, I believe anyone could turn it around. And there is hope out there, and especially, you know, thanks to you, Jonathan.
Well, thanks. Lynn, any advice?
Yeah, I would say that definitely do not accept the statement that they'll grow out of it. Don't believe that for a moment. And keep searching for somebody that is helping. If you're in a situation and you feel like nothing is working, then you need to move and try something else, because it probably is not working. And whoever is helping you needs to be working with the parent also.
And Mike?
Believe in yourself. Don't give up. Always keep trying. And you got to get out of your comfort zone to overcome your problems, or else things will never change.
Okay, and that concept of comfort zone that Michael is using is multidimensional. It's not only behavioral and situational. What it is it's how to use the brain in a different way. Now, let me leave you with a few thoughts. we're going to continue next week, same time. We're going to have a lawyer. We're going to have a doctor. We're going to have another parent. I'm going to answer more questions, and I do believe I'm going to open up the line for direct questions. There will be options for people who do want to get further assistance. I'm going to be offering group mentoring over the telephone, kind of like what we're doing tonight, small group parenting. There is a self-help audio program for selective mutism that will be ready in a week. There are very, very few openings for family individual therapy, but there are some. We will be sending you information about this. You can go later in the week or next week to selectivemutismseminar.com for more information or socialanxiety.com. You can call me at 800-248-2034. But the most important thing that I wanted to give the listeners tonight is the belief. You know, this wasn't a paid infomercial here. These were real patients who had a real experience, who are talking, who are sharing their experiences because they want to help other people because they've been through it. There is a resolution to the problem. If you demystify, selective mutism is not some abstract medical disorder. It's a very specific thing, social anxiety, avoidance, and dependence. So hosts, stay on the line for a minute, and we'll be back next week, same time. I wish you good health this week. Thanks.